This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. For 15 years, the IBM Center for the Business of Government has sought to connect research to practice, sponsoring third-party research on a broad range of public management issues facing us today. Decisions based on bad information can lead to poor results, be costly, and culminate in the squandering of opportunities. At a time of shrinking budgets and increasing expectations to do more with less, making better decisions based on informed judgment has taken on greater significance. In a world inundated with all kinds of information, timely and relevant and more predictive data can drive better decision-making. Both government entities and private organizations are collecting, analyzing, and interpreting tremendous amounts of quantitative information to maximize efficiency and output. Law enforcement agencies are at the forefront, leveraging data and using innovative software to generate predictions that help police prevent crime from occurring and solve open cases. What is predictive policing? How does it complement traditional policing methods? And what are some of the operational challenges to implementing predictive policing? We will explore these questions and the IBM Center report, Predictive Policing, Preventing Crime with Data and Analytics, with its author, Jen Bochner, from the Center for Advanced Government Studies at Johns Hopkins University. So, Jen, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
When I have our guests on, I like to talk about context and provide some context. Why is decision-making in all sectors of society increasingly driven by data and analytics? And how are business leaders and public servants increasingly leveraging the data and analytics?
Well, today it's easier than ever before to collect, store, and analyze data, which is why you see an increase in data-driven decision-making. With respect to data collection in the retail sector, for example, it has been inexpensive for a few years now for a retailer to track your purchases in physical stores through loyalty cards and items you browsed online. Today, retailers are even able to take the next step by tracking your movements within a store through cell phone location data. So making predictions about what a person is likely to purchase in the future becomes a lot easier as the amount of data increases. In addition, software programs like SPSS Modeler allow analysts who may not be experts in the underlying math to still develop sophisticated predictive models. To answer the second part of your question, business and government leaders are leveraging data and analytics for several purposes, including evaluating whether a program or policy has achieved its goals, identifying future needs related to human capital, and predicting future behavior, whether that's customer behavior or criminal behavior.
Mm-hmm. So with the emergence of big data and accessible analytic methods, several new approaches to police practice have appeared, and that's really the crux of your report. It focuses on predictive policing methods. So would you tell us more about these new approaches?
Sure. Well, predictive policing is the use of data and analytics to solve open cases and prevent crime from happening in the first place. Police departments around the country have embraced this approach because it allows them to keep crime rates down despite their limited resources. The overarching mentality of predictive policing is that crime can be prevented and solved using data and analytics in conjunction with traditional policing tools. The specific methods that police analysts employ are quite varied, and they depend on the nature of the problem or question that's being addressed. One problem, for example, might call for the use of a social network analysis, and another might require a geographic mapping tool.
So the history of quantitative criminal analysis spans centuries. And again, this is sort of giving folks a little bit of a context around the main part, main focus of your report. Would you provide us a brief overview of the origins of criminal analysis?
Well, quantitative crime analysis is actually several hundred years old. A couple centuries ago in the 1800s, scholars mapped crime data on top of education data, for example, to determine whether or not there was an identifiable correlation between those two variables. In the 1900s, the U.S. federal government began collecting national crime statistics, and these data have facilitated a tremendous amount of research on crime trends and the causes of crime. Today, research uses data not only to understand the patterns of crime over time and why crimes occurred in the past, but now also to predict where crime is likely to occur in the future.
Mm-hmm. And crime prevention is defined as efforts to restrict crime from occurring. And it's generally considered to encompass three pillars. Would you elaborate on those pillars?
Sure, I can talk about each one. Each of these pillars refers to a different set of actors in the criminal justice system. So the first pillar is crime prevention strategies, and these are intended to minimize the risk factors that are associated with criminal behavior. So crime prevention programs, for example, are often housed in schools and community centers, and they assist with improving the health and well-being of at-risk children and young adults. The second pillar in criminal prevention is criminal justice strategies. Those who work in juvenile correction facilities and prison rehabilitation programs are part of this pillar, and they aim to prevent convicted criminals from offending again. Lastly, the third pillar is law enforcement strategies, and these are the efforts undertaken by police to prevent crime. Often these efforts are aimed at reducing the opportunity for crime. So, for example, police can deter crime by stationing officers in strategic locations, such as outside of a bar when it closes at night or in an area that's susceptible to burglaries.
So you mentioned in your report, Jen, that there's a shift to intelligence-led policing and predictive analytics. How does predictive analytics now complement and supplement law enforcement strategies aimed at crime prevention? And why is the goal of predictive policing more proactive rather than reactive?
Sure. Well, the term intelligence-led policing usually refers to the use of quantitative evidence to guide decision making. So New York City was the first department to implement CompStat, which you may have heard of. Mm-hmm. And this is really a philosophy more than anything else. So under CompStat, a police department collects crime data and evaluates its performance based on that data. So CompStat is really a means of holding officers and departments accountable. Predictive policing, on the other hand, is entirely focused on the proactive side of the equation. So under CompStat, data is gathered to assess the past, whereas under predictive policing, data is gathered to predict the future. It's to prevent crime from happening in the first place. But there's still a role for CompStat in determining which predictive policing strategies are ultimately effective. So CompStat serves an evaluative role.
So, Jen, the increasing availability of data has fueled the development of statistical methods that, while on the cutting edge of policing, are nonetheless distinct from predictive methods. Would you tell us more about non-predictive uses of crime data and how they can determine why crimes occur in certain areas?
Sure. Well, much of the data that has been collected and the methods that have been developed recently are incredibly useful to police departments and criminologists, but not necessarily in a predictive capacity. For example, criminologists and sociologists use crime to understand the determinants or the causes of crimes. These researchers might be tackling issues such as the relationship between childhood neglect and criminal behavior in adulthood. So by collecting and analyzing this data, policymakers can make more informed decisions about how to allocate resources related to the other pillars of crime prevention, such as programs for at-risk youth and those that are housed within juvenile justice facilities.
Would you describe some key components of the crime analysis model and the relationship between them?
Well, the crime analysis process is multi-step, and it's often iterative. The first step is question formulation. So the crime analyst needs to first identify the question that he or she wishes to answer using analytics. The next step is for the analyst to identify and collect the data that he or she needs to answer the question that they formulated. After collecting the data, the analyst must clean the data, which is often an extremely difficult task. And that's because quantitative data in its raw form must be transformed and recoded so that it can be used in an analytical program. And this process, for anyone who's done it, knows that it can be extremely time consuming. Next, the crime analyst finally gets to the fun part, which is the analysis. The particular analytical method used will depend on the question that's being asked. After obtaining the results, the analyst develops a set of actionable recommendations for officers on the beat. Open lines of communication between officers and analysts are critical to ensuring that the recommendations align with both the data and what's realistic to implement. After the recommendations have been developed, officers can then act on those recommendations. And finally, it's important that police departments evaluate the success of the actions taken to determine if the crime analysis process is functioning as it should.
So, Jen, your research and your report for the IBM Center identifies that this stuff is not easy to do. And there are five commonly encountered challenges in pursuing predictive policing. Could you identify those?
Yeah, let me walk through them. The first challenge is collecting and managing the large amounts of data that are needed to fuel the crime analysis process. The data that are used come from various sources, including the federal and state governments. Departments must merge this data in such a way that it can be usefully incorporated into crime analysis models. Secondly, police departments must ensure that analysts are trained in both methods and substance. The Richmond Police Department has tackled this particular challenge with a unique organizational structure. In most police departments, analysts work either alongside officers on the beat or directly with each other. In Richmond, however, they use a hybrid model. So in this model, analysts spend part of their week working with each other and then the other part of the week in their assigned precinct. So they have an office in both locations. And this organizational structure ensures that the analysts are up to date on both analytical methods and substantive police work. A third challenge for departments is getting the resources they need to maintain effective predictive policing programs. So these programs require quite a substantial investment in both equipment and training, and it can be difficult for some departments to obtain this kind of investment. Fourth, departments must ensure that there is consistent and productive communication between analysts and police officers. The process of crime analysis functions most effectively when analysts and officers regularly communicate about the type of analysis that's needed to solve a problem, whether the recommendations can actually be implemented, and whether the actions that were taken were successful. And lastly, the fifth challenge is that it's critical for police departments to ensure that there's officer action in response to the analyses that are undertaken. Without officer follow-through, the analyses won't prevent any crime.
So the theory that the past can be used to predict the future relies on the assumption that crime, like any phenomena, can be discussed in probabilistic terms and has both a systematic and non-systematic component. But would you elaborate on each of these components? And is there another way to frame the systematic and non-systematic components?
Yeah, let me break this down. So all events have systematic and non-systematic components. So the systematic component includes things that are predictable, whereas the non-systematic component includes things that are non-predictable. Let me give you an example. So suppose I'm trying to predict an individual's likelihood of purchasing a new car. The systematic component of that decision might include the number of years that person has owned his current car and the number of cars he has purchased in the past. These are variables that are consistent predictors of new car purchasing. On the other hand, this individual might decide not to purchase a car after all because he unexpectedly loses his job. This is a non-predictable turn of events that influences the purchasing decision. The exact same type of framework can be applied to criminal decision making. Some crimes are highly predictable because they have a strong systematic component. The decision to commit a burglary, for example, is usually driven by the season, the time of day, the property value, and the presence of escape routes. These predictors are fixed and they're known to police. Homicides, on the other hand, are very difficult to predict because they are often driven by non-systematic factors, such as a flaring of passion. The key takeaway point here is that some crimes have strong systematic components and are therefore quite predictable, whereas others have strong non-systematic components, which makes them very difficult to predict. Predictive policing is likely to be most effective when it's used for crimes that have strong systematic components.
Jen, the amount of data available to police is growing at an exponential rate. Emerging predictive methods can incorporate data from a wide range of sources to generate predictions about where crime is likely to occur and where suspects are likely to be located. Would you describe for us those categories and present examples of variables in each of these categories?
Absolutely. Well, there are an infinite number of variables that can be incorporated into models that predict crime. So for ease of reference, I divide these variables into three categories to provide a sense of the types of variables that analysts have found to be particularly useful. The first category includes variables that characterize a physical location. For example, if we know the property values associated with a location and whether that location is near highways and bridges, we can make an educated guess about the likelihood of a burglary taking place in that location. The second category includes variables that characterize different time periods. These variables include payday schedules and seasonal weather. For example, we know that the burglary rate tends to rise in the summer, and that's because people are more likely to be away from their home then. And finally, the third category includes variables that characterize an individual's social network. For example, if police know a suspect's family members and friends, they can more easily cut off a suspect's social network. The Richmond Police Department successfully used this approach and was able to apprehend a suspect who eventually turned himself in.
There are three categories of analysis techniques that police departments use to predict crime, Jen. Would you elaborate on each of these categories, the type of analysis commonly undertaken, and the advantages and disadvantages of each?
Sure. So one of the most commonly used methods of predictive policing is the creation of maps that indicate locations that are likely to experience heightened levels of crime in the future. Often these maps take the form of hotspot maps, which you may have heard of. Hotspots are often determined by the distribution of crimes that occurred in the past, with more recent crimes being weighted more heavily. A second class of methods includes those that employ measures of both time and space. For example, crime analysts can use analytics to examine the path a serial criminal has taken and predict his or her next move. So this is useful when trying to predict the next target of a serial offender. A computer algorithm takes into account the times and locations of the crimes committed and generates a prediction about the location of the next likely offense. Police can then station themselves at that location and hopefully intercept the offender. A third class of methods includes those that involve the analysis of social networks. A criminal's social network might include his friends, family members, victims, and even business associates. A police department might perform a social network analysis to cut off a suspect's social resources, as the Richmond Police Department did. Or it might use the network to determine the best person through which to communicate information to a suspect. Each of these classes of methods has advantages and disadvantages, which you noted. Hotspot mapping, for example, is relatively straightforward, and therefore it's an accessible form of analysis. The output from this type of analysis is quite simple. I mean, it's just a map that clearly indicates the locations that are likely to experience crime in the future. So with a fairly small amount of training, officers can incorporate these maps into their daily decision making. The downside of this approach, however, is that it doesn't really leverage much of the data that's becoming available to police departments. The advantage of a social network analysis is that it can be tremendously useful for answering questions about how to isolate an offender or how to transmit information to an offender. One of the disadvantages of a social network analysis is that the researcher has to make a lot of subjective decisions, such as deciding which individuals to include and which to exclude from the social network. It can also be difficult to collect enough information about a suspect's social network to construct a complete network.
How are actual police departments using predictive policing? We will explore this question and so much more on our special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors returns. What is fast government and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's real estate footprint? And how are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness with Jen Bochner, author of the IBM Center report, Predictive Policing, Preventing Crime with Data and Analytics. So, Jen, your report does a wonderful job of explaining the components of predictive policing, but it also does a terrific job of outlining three case studies. And I'd like to explore each one of these case studies. They're police agencies that have been successful in using these methods. Could you tell us a little bit about the use of predictive policing in the Santa Cruz, California Police Department?
Of course. Well, the Santa Cruz Police Department is one of the first in the country to employ predictive policing in its daily operations. This department uses the PredPol software program, which was developed by researchers at UCLA and Santa Clara University. The software generates maps that indicate 15 150 by 150 meter squares that are most likely to experience crime during an officer shift. So prior to their shifts, officers are briefed on these 15 locations. And during their shifts, they can log into a web-based system and obtain a real-time updated hotspot map. The use of analytics has served the Santa Cruz Police Department extremely well because the geographical territory covered by this department is very large. So the maps help the officers allocate their time in an efficient manner. Further, the maps are particularly useful for officers who have less experience because they provide guidance as to where those officers should position themselves. In its evaluation, Santa Cruz has observed that the hotspot maps have been extremely effective in helping the department lower crime. This department observed a 27% drop in their burglary rate in the year after the implementation of its predictive policing program.
Another case study is the Baltimore County, Maryland Police Department. How have they used it to interdict suspects in serial robberies?
Well, a few years ago, there was a string of convenience store robberies, and officers were having a lot of trouble locating the offender, but they had identified the car that was used. So to solve the case, analysts used what's called a journey to crime analysis. In this analysis, the analyst plots the robberies on a map and then uses a computer algorithm to locate a point between the robberies that's likely to be the offender's residence. So in this case, the analyst then calculated all of the routes from this point, the suspected residence of the offender, to the crime locations, and then identified a street that the suspect was likely to use frequently. Police then staked out the street and lo and behold, were able to apprehend the suspect. In a similar case, analysts use analytics to solve a string of grocery store robberies. In this case, analysts use a directional analysis to identify a store that was likely to be the scene of the next crime. Police staked out the store and were able to intercept the offender when he showed up as expected.
So the last case study in your report involves Richmond, Virginia, and the police department, its use of predictive policing. Would you tell us more about how they used it?
Well, Richmond has also had a lot of success through the use of predictive analytics. For example, analysts were confronted with a string of parking lot attendant robberies, and they were having a lot of trouble apprehending the suspect. So using analytics, the analysts observed that particular parking lots that had been robbed had certain commonalities. These particular lots were surrounded by buildings as opposed to being surrounded by streets. They were frequently used during major events when the attendants had a lot of cash on hand. In addition, the analysts observed that certain parking lots were targeted on weekends while others were targeted on weekdays, and that the offender appeared to be moving in a counterclockwise direction. So taken together, the analysis indicated which lots were likely to be targeted next. So police were able to establish surveillance at those lots and then apprehend the suspect as he was exiting the scene of his most recent crime. In addition to using this type of analysis, Richmond has also had a lot of success using social network analysis. There was one case in which officers had spent a month trying to locate a homicide suspect who was on the run. So analysts decided to construct a network of the suspect's family and friends to identify which individuals were central to his social resources. Officers then contacted those central individuals to let them know that the suspect was wanted for a homicide and that they should contact police if the suspect made contact with them. The suspect quickly realized that he had been completely isolated by the police, and he actually turned himself over within a matter of hours.
So, Jen, what prompted your research in this area? Would you tell us more about how you conducted your research for the report and who participated and why?
Sure. So the topic is actually at the intersection of two topics that I studied, government and data analysis. And this intersection is becoming a field in its own right, which touches everything from national security to the regulation of the Internet. And I am particularly enthusiastic about it because we will soon be offering at Johns Hopkins a Master's of Science in Government Analytics, which will provide students with the data analysis tools that can improve decision making in the realms of public policy, politics, and governance. What is particularly interesting to me about the topic of predictive policing is its broader lessons for the agencies that are outside of law enforcement. The methods that police departments are using can be useful to any agency that is looking to save money while maintaining a high level of service to its constituents. This research was funded by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, and it involved a combination of interviews with police officers and analysts. I did some data analysis and also some program analysis.
Can I ask you, why did you choose those three case studies?
These particular police departments happen to be on the cutting edge of predictive policing.
So what about you? Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your interests?
Sure. Well, at the Johns Hopkins Center for Advanced Governmental Studies, I teach classes on quantitative methods and public opinion, and I'm currently working on the launch of our government analytics degree. My background is in political science, and I've always been interested in the creative use of data to make judgments about policy matters. In the past, I've studied voting behavior, including the impact of redistricting on electoral outcomes. I've also studied the impact of civic education on political participation, and in particular, the significant benefits that civic education yields for students whose families don't discuss politics in their home.
The analysis presented in this report and the interviews with crime analysts at police departments across the U.S. yield a set of recommendations for cities and counties that may be considering a predictive policing program. Would you elaborate on your initial recommendation?
Well, my first recommendation is that police departments and other government agencies take the plunge and implement a predictive analytics program. There are some challenges to implementing this kind of program, such as startup costs associated with purchasing the necessary software and training employees, but the benefits are truly substantial. Police departments that have used these methods have been able to keep their crime rates down and solve open cases with flat and, in many cases, lower budgets.
Jen, why is it important to treat predictive policing as an addition to, not a substitute for, traditional policing methods?
Well, all of the police departments I spoke with emphasized that predictive analytics are best used as a complement to officers' judgment and intuition. These methods don't provide substitute information. They provide additional information, and they should be thought of as additional tools in an officer's toolkit. One crime analyst I spoke with from the Santa Cruz Police Department drew a helpful analogy to phishing. He explained that predictive methods, and particularly hotspot maps, can tell officers where the best phishing holes are located, but not how to cast a line or bait a hook. So data and analysis more broadly can never replace sound judgment and qualitative assessments.
But would you elaborate on the reasons to avoid a top-down implementation of predictive policing efforts? And are there any implementation lessons that you'd like to share?
Well, police departments have consistently found that officer buy-in is greatest when the implementation is not top-down. In other words, it's important that a predictive policing program not be imposed on officers. In practice, officers who incorporate predictive methods of analysis into their policing strategy often experience positive results, and these success stories motivate their fellow officers to adopt the use of these methods as well. So peer motivation has proven to be the best means of encouraging officers to use these methods effectively.
So, Jen, one of the biggest advances in predictive analytics is the ability to leverage real-time data. To that end, how critical is it to keep the software accessible to officers on the beat?
Well, the probability that a crime will occur in a particular area can change dramatically with the passage of time. So it's helpful if officers can access the software during their shifts. This allows them to generate up-to-the-minute hotspot maps or incorporate a new piece of information into a predictive model. So many departments, including Baltimore, are in the process of giving officers greater access to software while they're out on their beats. Many software programs currently have in-car and mobile device capabilities, but it's going to take some time for departments to complete the implementation process.
Jen, to what extent should a department consider the geographic and demographic nature of its jurisdictions, and what are the implications for doing so?
Well, certain predictive methods tend to be much more useful in some jurisdictions than in others. Let's take New York City, for example. This city consists of high-density police beats. So what this means is that each officer's beat covers a relatively small geographical area in which a lot of people live. So in this type of area, a hotspot map, which identifies a small area in which an officer should devote more attention, is not super helpful. Methods that involve social network analysis, on the other hand, may be quite useful in this type of jurisdiction. A jurisdiction like Santa Cruz, in contrast, benefits greatly from the use of hotspot maps. And that's because each officer's beat covers a very large territory. So officers have to make critical decisions about how to allocate their time geographically.
So what steps can departments take to ensure that they collect accurate and timely data?
Well, predictive methods, like all statistical methods, of course, are only as good as the data that goes into them. This is why it's so important that police departments collect accurate data and timely data. And this can be achieved both through better data sharing and better data collection. So police departments can now easily share data with one another through programs like the Law Enforcement Information Exchange and the Digital Information Gateway. What's nice about these programs is that they also allow departments to obtain crime-related data from state and federal government agencies. In addition to data sharing, departments must improve their data collection processes. Several departments currently suffer from massive data entry backlogs, which infringe on their ability to use predictive methods as effectively as possible. To address this issue, departments such as Baltimore County are moving toward a data entry system that is available to officers right in their patrol cars. So this would allow officers to enter information into a computer at the scene of a crime, rather than simply completing a handwritten port that needs to be entered at a later time.
So, Jen, I'd like to turn to leadership and the importance of leadership in making these programs successful. How important is it that predictive policing programs have leaders that have expertise in analytical methodologies, police work, and communications? And could you elaborate?
Yeah, it's of utmost importance. So as is the case in most situations, good leadership in a predictive policing program is essential. In a predictive policing context, a great leader is somebody, as you noted, who has expertise in analytical methods, police work, and communication. And this can be a pretty tough combination to find. The leader has to be able to oversee the analytical work being done. He or she has to be able to collaborate with officers to ensure that the analyses and recommendations meet their needs. And the leader has to communicate the overall results to oversight bodies and to the public.
When do you think your master's program will be up and running?
It should be up and running by summer 2014 and in full swing by fall 2014.
And what is it going to look like? What kind of credits do you need, and how does it work?
Great question. So the Master's of Science in Government Analytics is a 12-course degree program, and students can concentrate in a few different areas such as statistical analysis, geospatial analysis, and public management. And the purpose of the program is to provide students with a set of highly sophisticated quantitative skills that allow them to be better policymakers, advisors to politicians, and executives in government agencies.
I found that your report, Predictive Policing, for the IBM Center will be highly useful for law enforcement community, but also government leaders in general, in understanding the potential of predictive analytics in improving performance in a wide range of areas. And so I want to thank you for joining us today, and I want to thank you for your work for the IBM Center.
Oh, thanks very much for having me here.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness with Jen Bochner, from the Center for Advanced Government Studies at Johns Hopkins University and author of the IBM Center report, Predictive Policing, Preventing Crime with Data and Analytics. You may order or download a free copy of this report and all Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Next up, we'll explore in more depth analytics with Professor Tom Davenport as this special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How can serendipitous collision change the way agencies do business? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's footprint? Get your latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Get your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? What is national health security, and how do we get there as a country? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas to improve government effectiveness. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. It's no secret that companies have, for some time, successfully analyzed data to gain a competitive edge. Now that competitive analytics and business intelligence techniques are mainstream, to what extent can government use these techniques to enhance its own performance? We'll explore these and many other aspects with our very special guest, Tom Davenport, Distinguished Professor in Information Technology and Management at Babson College, and co-author of Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning. Tom, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure having you.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Analytics is becoming a requirement in almost every industry as companies face increased competition. What are analytics, and what are the types of information used in analytics?
Well, I really define analytics as systematic efforts to analyze data in a quantitative fashion. So that might be statistics, econometrics. Sometimes people get into textual analytics, particularly in the intelligence field. Anytime you use systematic analysis of data to help make a decision.
Tom, government agencies don't compete, but they definitely have a use for strategic analytics. Would you describe how analytics and fact-based decision-making can assist government agencies?
Sure, Michael. There are a lot of opportunities, and I think while government organizations may not be competing on analytics, you're starting to see some evidence that they are beginning to transform themselves through the use of analytics. You see it in certain sectors. Certainly, intelligence has often been about analytics, and they're heavy users of it and have been for a while. The big initiative there is, how do we get different intelligence agencies in the United States to share all that data? Healthcare, huge issue right now. How do we use comparative effectiveness analytics to know which treatment is really most effective and most worth paying for? How do we use analytics to identify the patients who are most likely to contract diabetes, say? Diabetes and congestive heart failure account for only about 30% of the patients in Medicare, but they account for about 75% of the spending. So if we can identify a diabetes patient before they actually contract the disease and head it off through diet and exercise and behavior, you know, that's great for the government and great for the patient. So big initiatives in healthcare. Taxes, I'm afraid, are another area where analytics are pretty heavily used to kind of identify the people who might be underpaying or not paying at all their taxes, and to go after them and to figure out, really, you know, just as with other organizations, tax agencies have to segment their customers, so to speak, and identify the ones who are both most likely to be not paying and those who are most likely to be responsive when you're trying to collect, because you can't go after everybody with equal vigor. And then certainly in the military, there have always been a lot of analytical activities related to supply chain. The Army, in particular, very focused on kind of the human supply chain of how do we attract people to enlist in the first place, and who's most likely to stay with us over time so we can kind of focus our efforts on keeping the people in who we think have a good chance of doing that. But all sorts of opportunities, I think, but still early days.
Yeah. In your report for the IBM Center for the Business of Government entitled Strategic Use of Analytics in Government, you outlined the Delta model for assessing analytic capability. Would you describe the model and how these traits apply to the public sector?
I think, you know, even if you're just listening to the radio, you can remember this fairly easily. So D is for data, as you suggested earlier, Michael. You got to have good data, and organizations that are really competitive about this tend to think a lot about, well, what might be something new or unique that I don't have already in terms of data that could really help this process. So that might be at Harrah's, it's how frequently do the employees smile at customers. That's apparently a big driver of customer satisfaction. So they measure smile frequency. Postal Service has got a big effort to measure how long it actually takes time in transit to get a package through and what percentage of the time does it meet their standards. So getting that data is a big first step. E is for enterprise, and we found that when companies compete on analytics, they tend to view analytics as an enterprise, not as a bunch of little localized silos. So that's combining data, that's combining analytical people in many cases, and also combining, you know, technology and technology solutions. L in the Delta model is for leadership, probably the single most important thing. So, you know, if you've got somebody leading the charge, you'll do very well. In government, I think the best example of that is when Dr. Ken Kaiser was head of the VA, really led the charge on putting electronic medical records in place and starting to do things like disease management and so on with that data. T is for target. So where's your focus? For the VA, it's probably going to be on something involving patient care. For the Postal Service, it's probably going to be around something related to logistics as a primary target, because that's where you spend all your money and that's what creates your performance. For a private sector organization like a Harrah's, it's on customer loyalty. So eventually, analytical orientations can kind of spread out into a variety of areas, but you need to start with a target. And then finally, A is for analysts. If you want to be highly analytical, you need to either have some internal capabilities, or you need to find them somehow. You know, maybe consultants or contractors can help in that regard, but you need some people who are able to think analytically, who can do the data analysis for you, and even more important, who can communicate effectively with decision makers about what the numbers say. So one of my research organizations calls that, you know, PhDs with personality. It's great to have the math skills, but you also need to be able to communicate and build trust among decision makers.
Now, you mentioned earlier the use of strategic analytics in healthcare, and I was hoping you could drill down a little more in terms of where do you see it being used most effectively? Evidence-based medicine, disease management, and even with Medicaid, Medicare fraud.
Yeah. Well, it's happening in all of those areas. I think certainly for, you know, to make healthcare reform really work, we're going to have to, you know, not just insure more people and make it possible to get health insurance even if you have a pre-existing condition, but we're going to have to get better at how we actually provide healthcare. And analytics are often the key to that. You have some private healthcare institutions like Intermountain Healthcare in Utah, Partners Healthcare in my neck of the woods in Boston, that have done some great work at embedding evidence-based medicine into actual day-to-day practice. So at Partners, for example, they have a semi-automated system that has care protocols that have been, you know, validated through statistics and research that, you know, if a patient comes in with a certain set of conditions, the system is going to recommend that the physician give a certain drug or follow a certain care protocol. Now, the physician can override, and that's pretty important, I think, in medicine, because the physician may know something that the system doesn't. But increasingly, we're going to do evidence-based medicine and not leave it up to humans to remember all of that, but embed it into systems. And that's what the VA did early on with their electronic medical record system, and increasingly the leading private healthcare institutions are doing the same thing. Still a small percentage, but that's definitely the direction that it's going. In Medicare and Medicaid, the focus is, as you suggested, disease management to identify the really expensive cases that we can might be able to head off a little bit or at least treat more effectively, and then to identify fraud. Obviously, Medicaid is going to be done at the state level since that's how it's administered. Medicare is going to be done more at the federal level, and a lot of activity, obviously much more fragmented for Medicaid, but a lot of activity in both cases to eliminate fraud for people who, you know, file claims or whatever that don't really deserve to be paid back for them.
You had mentioned also government revenue management. Would you drill down a little bit on that one, too, and explain to us where it could be used effectively?
Sure. So the general feeling is that there's this phenomenon called the tax gap, which is the gap between what we should be paying and what we're actually paying. And most people tend to believe it's about 15%. So obviously that leads to a pretty big number if you can increase that through analytics. And so the IRS for a number of years, actually a couple of decades, has been identifying people who are not paying what they probably should be paying based on what other factors we know about them. It's called the Taxpayer Compliance Measurement Program. It probably could be a little bit more aggressive. I think the payoffs from doing analytical work in revenue management tend to be huge, roughly tenfold. So if I were a congressman, I would send money to the IRS to do analytical work because it really pays off in a big way. Sweden is probably, of all the tax authorities around the world, is probably the most aggressive one we found at using analytics to not only identify people who don't pay enough, but really to kind of build confidence in the tax authorities that, you know, the rules make sense and that people are encouraged to perform the right behaviors as far as their taxes are concerned. A lot of tax problems are errors, not criminal intent. And I guess a big part of that confidence in the tax agency is confidence that they'll get you if you don't pay what you're supposed to. But they've really built their strategy around it, and as far as we can tell, are the most aggressive revenue management agency. A lot of state work in that regard, too, in the United States. Massachusetts, my state, unfortunately, is they haven't come after me yet, but someday they probably will. Really big on using analytics. Texas is another one. So a lot of, you know, isolated efforts at the states in that regard.
Well, what's interesting is you mentioned Sweden as an example. Are there other international examples where strategic analytics are happening more effectively in the government realm that maybe the governments, local, state, municipal governments in the United States could emulate?
Well, most of our research for the Center for the Business of Government was about the U.S. This Swedish one stuck out. My co-author on this project was Finnish, so maybe she was a little bit more oriented to Scandinavia. But certainly in healthcare, the analytical activities are taking place all throughout the globe. It really, you can look at how likely analytics are. Single best driver is how long ago did they put in an electronic medical record system? So Canada had one a while ago, and they are into analytics in a fairly substantial way in healthcare. The British system, despite being nationalized, does not have a common electronic medical record system. And so, you know, they don't have good data yet. There's some other areas. Canada has done some really interesting work in the fire prevention area. I'm told there are a lot of trees up in Canada, and they own a lot of public land that's forested, and so hard to fight fires in all of those areas equally well. So they use a big geographical database and some predictive analytics to say where are the fires most likely to occur, and they pre-position firefighting resources in those areas so that they can be ready to fight them. And they say it's saved thousands of hectares of forest land in that fashion. The other area, of course, is in crime prevention, and that's happening around the world as well, a little bit more at the local level than the federal level in the U.S. So New York City.
CompStat.
Yeah, with CompStat and the real-time crime center that IBM runs for them. Mostly reporting-oriented, but still, you know, very much data-oriented. And I was reading some numbers last night. Since CompStat, major crime in New York City is down 74%. So it's really a dramatic story. Probably some other factors going on, like demographics and so on, but you got to be impressed by the results there.
And at least you understand the data is there.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think the other thing that's key is a lot of different police departments around the country have adopted CompStat, some with much less success. What I think made it work in New York City and in any place where Bill Bratton, who implemented it there, he moved on to Los Angeles and recently retired from there. He engaged the whole police force in it. So everybody had to come to CompStat meetings. Everybody is being asked questions about, what's in your data and why haven't you responded to it and so on. So kind of that leader putting on the organizational pressure helps a huge amount.
So, Tom, from your research, what advice would you have for government agencies in order to get to where they need to be in order to leverage the right amount of analytics?
Well, if you look at the Delta model, Michael, I think the D is not a problem. There's plenty of data in many agencies. There may have to be some remedial work, but there's enough to work on, I suspect. The E is an issue in government because we tend to be pretty fragmented in most agencies. The analytical people aren't talking to each other. In the intelligence community, they're working on that and having a Directorate of National Intelligence. One of the things they're trying to do is to share more information and be more enterprise-oriented with regard to analytics, but I think still a long way to go. The L word is probably the biggest problem in that we don't have enough highly analytical leaders in government who are able to really press for this and devote the resources to it and so on. So I'm hoping that somehow they will emerge fairly soon. Targets thing is not that tough. I think for most government agencies, they can figure out where are the most fruitful targets. I was talking to some of the people in the Social Security Administration, and for them, one of the initial targets for analytics was giving people who are disabled benefits as soon as possible, really speeding that process along. So, that's a natural result for an organization that's really, trying to help its constituents. Finally, the A word for analysts, in a way, it's a problem because there aren't that many in government. Less of a problem because you can fairly easily procure them externally. A number of the Medicaid fraud organizations go outside and work with contractors on that. But I think the key in government, particularly in the intelligence sector, is we call people analysts who aren't very analytical. There have been a couple of studies recently suggesting that in the CIA and the NSA and so on, the analysts tend to rely more on intuition and experience more than analytics, despite the fact that, we have a vast amount of data that's being analyzed at places like the NSA. I'm not sure that enough of that serious analytical work actually gets used in analyst reports and even less so in policymaker decision making. So at the start of the funnel, we do really well. At the end of the funnel, where it comes to analysts and decision makers, not so well with our analytical orientation in government.
Tom, what about next steps in implementing analytics in the government sector?
Well, I think there will be even more appetite for this going forward. If I were primarily focused on government, I think what I would try to do is develop some capability to educate senior policymakers on the value of this kind of approach and what their responsibilities are. This is not just something that the analysts can do by themselves. Executives need to ask the right questions, need to kind of push back when they don't understand something. That was another problem, by the way, in the financial crisis, is you had executives buying into models that they didn't really understand. And so, when things went south, they didn't know what to do about it. So I think in areas that we know are going to be big over the next several years, like healthcare, identifying what are some of the key analytical approaches that make sense, what are the key analytical targets, what should the government really be enforcing. One of the things that's happening in the health IT space is that you're going to get money for doing an electronic medical